everyone. This is Chinese teacher, Avian. You are listening to the Deathcast, True Crime Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist, Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our fifth look at the life and crimes of Joseph Paul Franklin. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for The Deathcast. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do that. You can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe to the show, and leave a 5-star review. Or you can go to Patreon at tinyurl.com/decastpatreon. Where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content, just as my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony, did, as well as my top monthly supporters, Samantha and Debbie. And I do need to give a shout-out to a brand new Patreon supporter this month. Becky just signed up a few days ago at the Deathcaster level. Thank you so much and welcome aboard, Becky. Again, that's tinyurl.com/decastpatreon. All right, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair. Kick back and relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last time, it was the end of 1979. Joseph Paul Franklin had been on his murderous rampage for about 2 years, starting off macing interracial couples in the face, then moving on to bombings of synagogues and homes before graduating to sniper attacks. Franklin would later state of this point in his life that by the time 1980 dawned, his ideological mission to start a race war and to eliminate as many blacks and people that he saw as race traitors was secondary to the fact that he had begun to enjoy the act of killing. And this is something that a lot of serial killers experience during their killing careers. Eventually, the act of killing, the hunting, the stalking is the only thing that really allows them to feel anything. Now, there are killers who are like this from the outset. Those who feel hollow and dead inside until they commit that first act of killing. But for many of them, this is a gradual process. It's the same way an alcoholic, you know, begins to feel nothing unless there is a drink involved. They anticipate the drink. The idea of it is the high that motivates them, that controls them and compels them to go and take that first drink. Many serial killers are the same way. They're compelled to commit murder. They're addicted to it just as any drug. Unfortunately, you know, with a serial killer, their drug of choice involves the taking of others' lives. And Franklin begins the year just as he ended the last year. January 1st of 1980, Joseph Paul Franklin registers at a hotel in Indianapolis, Indiana, and immediately sets out looking for potential targets, finally settling on a church's chicken on January 12th. Of 1980. At a little after 11 p.m. on the night of the 12th, Franklin takes his 30-30 and targets a mentally handicapped 19-year-old by Lawrence Reese, who was working inside of this church's chicken. Fortunately, Reese is shot once in the chest as he's waiting for the store to close so he could begin his cleanup, and dies instantly. Now, unlike previous crimes, Franklin did not flee this time. He sticks around Indianapolis, striking again on January 14th. At roughly 10:50 p.m., Joseph Paul Franklin targeted another 19-year-old black male by the name of Leo Thomas Watkins. Watkins was with his father, were waiting inside of the market for it to close so that the two of them could do an extermination job. However, this would not be the case, as Franklin shot Watkins once in the chest, killing him instantly. Describing his crimes, Franklin said that his intention was, quote, to get out of the area as soon as possible, move fast. You know what I'm saying? As soon as you do something like that, you get out and put as much space between you and that scene as possible. I mean, I just tried to put distance between me and that area. It's the way I operated, you know? I didn't believe in sticking around in the area. Bank robberies, all that too, you know, bombing, whatever. Unlike the previous crimes that Franklin had committed up until this point, these two murders involved the same murder weapon, and while officers were able to link both of these murders to the same individual due to this, they had no evidence to go on and no witnesses who reported seeing a shooter in the area when either of these crimes were committed. Officers also believe that Franklin may have been involved in another shooting that took place on Tuesday evening, January 15th. That was when 21-year-old Rita Hatcher was shot through the window of a house while she was attending a birthday party. Hatcher was hit in the chest, however, she survived her injuries. Detectives later said, quote, in all three cases, the victim was in a well-illuminated room at about 11 p.m. and was shot through a window. It should be noted, though, that while Joseph Paul Franklin admitted to the murders of the two 19-year-old men, he refused to claim any responsibility for the shooting of Hatchet. Franklin leaves the area after this, heading down into Georgia again. On January 20th, we know that he was in Milledgeville, Georgia, where he called his ex-wife, Collect. After this, Franklin heads to New Orleans, where he spends the period from the 24th through the 30th of January. And it's during this stay in New Orleans that Joseph Paul Franklin ends up getting arrested for carrying a concealed weapon, a handgun. Franklin gives false ID to the officers carrying the name of James A. Cooper, and after he is released from jail a week later, on the 31st, Franklin continues on his way. On March 1st, he ends up being stopped in Iowa for speeding. In early April, he is given another ticket, this time in Florida. You can start to see a little bit of an unraveling to Franklin at this point, as he had been extremely cautious prior to these three different offenses, avoiding any contact with law enforcement and really doing his best to keep a low profile. However, now we have three offenses in 3 months where he makes contact with law enforcement for doing something wrong, breaking the law. We have no known crimes other than bank robberies for Franklin at this point in time, although the possibility of further murders does exist. in mid-April, Franklin ends up purchasing a .30-06 from a man in Cincinnati before traveling back to Indianapolis, where he gets a driver's license under an assumed name. Somewhere during this, Franklin encounters a man he called B.J. Gann. Gann rides with Franklin for a period of time. It should be noted, however, that police do not believe that this B.J. Gann character had no knowledge of the crimes that Franklin was committing. Given what we know about Franklin, however, and his inability to keep his mouth shut to people, I have to believe that Franklin probably did say something to this man, you know, bragging about the crimes that he committed. However, it's likely that Gann simply took this as Franklin bragging. We know some individuals who did encounter Franklin during the course of his endless road trip stated that Franklin told them he had committed murders and bank robberies, but that a number of these people thought it was just Franklin trying to puff himself up and seem bigger and more dangerous than he actually was. Now, after leaving Indianapolis, Franklin meanders his way back to Wisconsin, which, if you'll recall, Franklin had previously visited back in 1977, where the first known murders of mixed-race couples that were tied to Franklin are known to have taken place. And it's with this in mind that he returns to the scene of the crime, as it were. Franklin's next victim was not a sniper attack, however. Was a young woman by the name of Rebecca Bergstrom. Rebecca was attending a secretarial school in Madison. We know that she was planning to return home to see her parents, was excited about this, had just returned from a trip to Jamaica where she had become in the habit of carrying her passport around her neck to ensure that it was not stolen. And by all accounts, this was a habit that she had continued once she returned to the States. On May 2nd, Rebecca, who was last seen wearing a tank top blouse and denim skirt, phoned her friend Linda Nuff to inform her that she wanted to come and see Linda. Now, Linda was attending college at the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire. Linda informed Rebecca that she was going to a party that afternoon, but she was certainly welcome to come out and spend the weekend. So Rebecca, armed with $300 that her parents had given her, decided to hitchhike out to Eau Claire. However, Rebecca ends up changing her plans, at least this is according to her parents. Rebecca decided instead to come home, hitchhiking to an uncle's house in Toma. Obviously, Rebecca's parents had warned her about the dangers of hitchhiking. However, Rebecca had said to them that so many of the students at the school came from her hometown of Frederick that they shouldn't worry, as it would be very easy for Rebecca to get a ride home. Sadly, this was not the case. Rebecca was last seen at roughly 2:30 p.m. on the afternoon of May 2nd, was in a restaurant in Madison. The following day, May 3rd, a man by the name of Scott Tormian and his friend Steve Calkett were hiking in Mill Bluff State Park, which is roughly 5 miles outside of Toma. As they later informed police, At roughly 4:40 that afternoon, they came upon the body of a woman lying face down near the trail with about $100 in small bills scattered in the dirt and underbrush around her body. Police were contacted. They come to the scene. They find the body without its shoes, although these are located not far away. And it's later determined that she had been shot with a .44 caliber handgun 3 times. Once in the lower back, once in the upper right shoulder, and once in the head. The girl had been dead for 1 to 2 days, according to the coroner's report. Obviously, we know that this is Rebecca. Unfortunately, there weren't a lot of clues for them to go off of. They found a piece of chrome from a bumper, as well as the glass from a taillight lens next to a tire track. Obviously, this is a small town. News makes the rounds quickly. And very soon, a man comes to the attention of the police as he's in a bar, drinking, bragging that he's responsible for Rebecca's death. As we're talking about Joseph Paul Franklin, you probably guessed it, this guy doesn't have anything to do with Rebecca's murder. It would not be until the mid-80s when Rebecca Bergstrom's murder would be solved. Joseph Paul Franklin admits to having encountered her while she was hitchhiking, picking her up, and during the course of their drive, Rebecca informs him that she had dated a Jamaican man while she was on vacation. This leads Franklin to murdering her. And it's very likely that there's a lot more crimes out there like this that Franklin either could not remember, as there's no telling how high his murder count really is, or took with him to the grave, as he did not want to share a particular crime. That's not uncommon with a serial killer. There are crimes they will not discuss, whether this is a crime that they're ashamed of or because something happened during their encounter with the individual who was murdered that they do not wish to divulge, such as a consensual sexual encounter or even a rape. Some serial killers do not want to admit to having committed the act of rape. We know from Joseph Paul Franklin's own statements, he did think of raping some of his victims. Franklin stated that after murdering Rebecca, he wandered aimlessly for a period of time trying to figure out what to do next. He stated in interviews that during this period of time, the idea of gaining notoriety for his crimes first began to make itself known to him, and that the more he was on the road and by himself, and the more that he thought about this, the more he desired this attention, this recognition for the crimes that he was committing. He said that murders like those of Rebecca Bergstrom left him feeling unfulfilled and failed to satiate his desire for murder. And again, turning back to the alcoholic simile, the more you have, the more you want. One's not enough. He's craving more and more violence. And this is what led to the attempted assassination of civil rights leader Vernon Jordan, and the series of 6 murders that we covered in the first episode. Now we're moving back into where we had left off after Franklin's killing spree that ends in Salt Lake City. If you'll recall, Franklin ends up getting arrested. He ends up escaping from the jail and vanishing, visiting his ex-wife Anita once before disappearing yet again. Now, the FBI is keeping tabs on things. They're learning as much as they possibly can about Joseph Paul Franklin, with input from all of these various law enforcement agencies across the country that have crimes that they believe fit the murders Franklin is suspecting of having carried out. They also have a letter he had sent to Jimmy Carter threatening the president's life. Well, at this point in time, Jimmy Carter is on the campaign trail hoping to secure a second term against Ronald Reagan, who's running for his first term in office. So the FBI sends out a warning to the Secret Service, and all campaign stops along Carter's trail, letting them know that they have this individual who's considered to be armed, highly intelligent, and extremely dangerous, who is suspected of having carried out multiple sniper attack murders across the United States, and who has made threats against the president's life. This brings us to October of 1980. We know that Franklin had stopped in Atlanta, Georgia. Well, now he has moved on to Florida. FBI agents later stated, "He's the type of person you do not want around during a presidential campaign. Also, we know he sent a threatening letter to President Carter in 1976. We wanted to make sure he was not down there when the presidential candidates were. We would feel much better knowing where he is at the time." Well, at this point in time, Carter is planning on giving a speech at a college in Lakeland, Florida. Franklin is staying in a gospel mission homeless shelter in Tampa. We know Franklin stayed there for 3 nights before traveling on to Lakeland on October 28th. Reason we know this is that Franklin actually used his birth name James Clayton Vaughn when he signed in to stay at the mission. The FBI would later learn that during this point in time Franklin is on the run, he attempted to buy a gun while he was in Florida. So armed with this information, the FBI descends on Florida, contacting local blood banks near Lakeland and distributing pictures of Franklin, letting them know that the man was extremely dangerous and he was known to go to blood banks to sell plasma in order to get money. And if you'll recall, Franklin ends up in this situation on the run because he got angry at the police for blocking his car in at a motel he was staying at under an assumed name, which allowed the police to discover his true identity and to start linking him to all of these various murders. So at this point, Franklin is really at the end of his rope. He's spiraling heavily. He's looking to do that one crime that's going to get him national, if not international, media attention and give him that recognition that he desperately is craving, while also hoping to start a race war. So this is an extremely volatile situation law enforcement have placed themselves into. They are also unaware at this point of Franklin's racist ideologies and his former associations with various white supremacist groups. Had they known of Franklin's past completely, there's a very good possibility that they would have been quieter in their hunting of Franklin. And I say that because law enforcement is well aware of what can happen. Even at this point in 1980, when an individual such as this ends up being taken down by law enforcement or ends up dying at the hands of law enforcement, it can create a situation where now they've made a martyr and others are going to copycat their crimes. And spoiler alert, Joseph Paul Franklin does end up becoming a martyr, so to speak, within the white supremacist movement. In fact, I would say it's safe to say he becomes a folk hero among these disturbed individuals. Now, on October 28th, about 4 hours after the FBI had visited the Saratech blood bank, Joseph Paul Franklin walked through the front door. As he's giving blood, one of the technicians informs the manager that Franklin matches the description of the flyer the FBI had given them. The FBI informs the blood bank that they will be there shortly and asks them to stall Franklin's departure, which the blood bank agrees to do. They ask Franklin to wait for 15 minutes before leaving, so he doesn't become dizzy or anything like that. While this is going on, the FBI contacts the Lakeland Police Department, and very quickly they decide that the best way to take him down is to wait outside the blood bank for Franklin to leave. Eventually, the blood bank gives Franklin a check for $5. Franklin asks him where he can cash the check. He's told that all of the banks are currently closed, but there's a diner around the corner where he can go and cash it. As Joseph Paul Franklin exits the blood bank, two cars pull up and he is quickly arrested without incident. Interestingly enough, officers allow Franklin to cash the check he has gotten from the blood bank before bringing him to the Lakeland Police Department. Officers noted that Franklin was quiet as he was taken into custody, and once at the police department during his fingerprinting, they also noticed that he had attempted to obscure or obliterate the tattoos that covered his arms. Franklin is positively identified through his fingerprints. Franklin is held at the FBI field office. Officers note that he continuously tried to scrape the tattoos off of his body while in custody, as he insisted that he was not Joseph Paul Franklin. The next day, October 29th, Franklin is allowed a phone call, and at this point he contacts his ex-wife, Anita. During the conversation, Franklin tells Anita that he has been arrested and accused of having committed multiple racist murders, saying, quote, "Have you heard about the two joggers in Salt Lake? I did that. They got me for 12 homicides down here and 4 bank robberies, and the funny thing is, it's true." During a 5-hour interview with FBI agents, Joseph Paul Franklin refused to admit any of the killings. However, he did admit to officers that he was an avowed racist. One officer letter stated about this interview, quote, "specifically talked about the mixing of the black and white races and expressed with very strong emotion his disapproval of such mixing." Franklin also is said to have shown no remorse over the deaths of such people. Further showing his racist colors, Franklin refused to eat food that officers offered him, as they could not guarantee Franklin that it had not been made by blacks. Of note from this interrogation, Franklin admitted to having been in Salt Lake City between August 15th and August 22nd of 1980. He also said he had a number of guns with him during this trip. When asked if he had ever been to Liberty Park, Franklin admitted to having been to the area, but stated he stopped going when he noticed all of the race mixing that was going on. When asked about the murders in Salt Lake City, Franklin stated he had nothing to do with them. Franklin is eventually turned over to U.S. Marshals, who hold him at a federal courthouse in Tampa. Franklin is given a court-appointed attorney, at which point Franklin, through his attorney, refuses to answer any more questions from law enforcement. Although officers did attempt to go through the Attorney General's office to offer a deal wherein Franklin would agree to talk to the officers with his attorney present, but this was rejected. Franklin appears in court for the first time on October 29, 1980, where the judge imposes a $1 million bond. Prosecutors discuss having Franklin transferred to Salt Lake City to stand trial for violating the civil liberties of Theodore Fields and David Martin. After this, Franklin voluntarily spoke to reporters where he denied any involvement in the killing, saying the charges were quote-unquote trumped up when one reporter asked whether or not Franklin was indeed a racist. He agreed that this was the case, informing them that he disagreed with race mixing as well as communism. We will be back in just a moment. Hey there, my D&Ders. This is your old buddy Ian here with a brand new sponsor this week. Now, you've all heard me talk about Chinese teachers in the past. I have never promoted a Chinese teacher quite like Chinese teacher Evian. Evian is a sweet, honest, and dedicated teacher who teaches every day. She not only makes certain that her students understand the differences in tonal pronunciation, she allows them the opportunity to get up during the class and read what it is that she is teaching so that each student knows that they are getting the best possible education and is pronouncing the words and tones correctly. So I'd like you to do right now is go to tinyurl.com/EvianCT and check her out. That's tinyurl.com/EvianCT. She makes learning this beautiful and wonderful language a lot of fun. And remember, Mandarin Chinese is the fastest growing language in the international job market today. This is the language that you want to learn if you don't want to work that boring 9-to-5 job, but you want to get a foothold in a company that has an international presence. They're all looking for Mandarin speakers. So let Evian be the one to introduce you to this language. You won't be disappointed. Hey there, D&Ders. Your friend Ian here with another brand new sponsor this week. Artwork by Katie. Now, as the son of a fairly successful artist, I grew up around the art world, saw many different styles of art. I know good art from bad, and I can honestly say that in addition to being a good friend, Katie is one of the best artists I have ever had the pleasure of seeing. Her works of art, be it drawings or paintings, are absolutely amazing. And Katie doesn't just do original works of art, she also does commission pieces. So if you're looking for that perfect piece of art to offset the decor in your home, office, or even in your place of business, go check out Artwork by Katie at linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. That's linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. You'll be blown away. Reporters asked Franklin whether or not he had come to Lakeland in order to assassinate President Carter. Franklin denied this. Eventually, it's announced that Franklin will be charged with violating the civil rights of Theodore Fields and David Martin in Salt Lake City. informing reporters that Franklin had committed these crimes because of the men's race. As with a lot of cases, Franklin's case involved jailhouse informants, one of whom came forward stating that Franklin had confessed to them on the night of October 29th that he had in fact murdered the joggers. Franklin's Camaro was transferred on November 2nd to Salt Lake City, where it was gone over with a fine-tooth comb. Now they've got Franklin in custody, they're going over his vehicle, they're starting to collect various hotel registries from across the country that they believe Franklin may have stayed at, which may tie him to further crimes. On November 3rd, a judge rules that Franklin will be extradited to Utah to stand trial for the murder of Fields and Martin. This judge also rules that Franklin must provide handwriting samples, as prosecutors claimed that he used at least 18 aliases in the commission of his numerous crimes. Franklin ends up being transferred to Salt Lake City on November 7th. Prior to this extradition, John Douglas, the famed FBI profiler, had informed the FBI that it was his belief that if Franklin were transferred by private jet, he might begin confessing, as Franklin was deathly afraid of flying and would look for emotional support from the agent that was with him. And this is exactly what ends up happening. Franklin begins acting twitchy and fidgety, and he starts to speak to the agent assigned to him. The agent informs Franklin of his Miranda rights, and Franklin waives them. At this point, the officer begins to record the conversation that he has with Joseph Paul Franklin. Franklin basically explains to this agent, Robert H. Dwyer, how he had gotten away with his crimes, the various methods he had used, how he had concealed his identity and repeatedly changed his appearance in order to avoid detection throughout the years. He talked about destroying the weapons that he had used, how he would purchase weapons from individual sellers as opposed to going to a gun dealer or a gun show, and then destroy said weapon afterwards. However, Franklin did not implicate himself in any of the murders initially. He would dance around the subject, placing himself in the city during a period of time when a murder took place, but denying any involvement. It's interesting to note, however, Franklin vehemently denied any knowledge or involvement in the Vernon Jordan murder, and agents later speculated this was because Franklin felt ashamed over having not killed the civil rights leader. At one point, the pilot is asked by the FBI agent Dwyer to fly over the Utah State Prison, which Dwyer points out to Franklin, stating that the prison is where Gary Gilmore had been executed, informing him that if he were found guilty of the murders of Ted Fields and David Martin, and the prosecution was able to persuade the jury to award Franklin a death sentence, it was more likely than not that Franklin himself would be executed inside of that very same prison. Franklin had different recollections of his conversation with Agent Dwyer, stating that Dwyer said, quote, "Man, they ought to give you a medal. You sure fixed those two N-words out there in Salt Lake. They ought to give you a medal for cleaning up the streets." And it's true that Dwyer did, in fact, say this. However, the court allows officers to lie during interrogations, calling it reasonable deception in order to elicit a confession from a criminal. The moral and legal ramifications of this type of technique are, at least to me, suspect. And eventually Franklin does start admitting to some of his crimes here and there. Franklin ends up being escorted in a motorcade, which, again, came from Douglas, who thought that this kind of building, stroking of Franklin's ego, of showing him that he was infamous and that, you know, they were taking him seriously, would make Franklin more pliable and more likely to give further confessions. On November 10th, Franklin puts in a plea of not guilty before a federal judge. As in Florida, Franklin is held on a $1 million cash bond and again ordered to submit to handwriting samples. At this hearing, the state of Utah informs the federal judge that they will wait to try Franklin until after the federal government has tried him for the crimes. This was largely due to the fact that the evidence that Utah had against Franklin mostly relied upon four eyewitnesses who could place Franklin and his Camaro in the area in the hour leading up to the murder of Fields and Martin. One of the state prosecutors stated, quote, "Although evidence in the case continues to accumulate, it is at this time premature to file state homicide charges against the prime suspect in the case, Joseph Paul Franklin. However, both prosecutors and police are hopeful that sufficient evidence upon which an appropriate homicide charge can be based will soon be developed. The federal charges are a separate and distinct matter from the local murder charges. The federal complaint supports the theory that the individual so charged did violate the civil rights of both Martin Fields because of their race and color." That being said, very soon after Franklin is arraigned in federal court, the state of Utah decides to bring charges against Franklin. Officers would later state that these charges were brought as, by the time Franklin's arraignment was over and done with, they felt that they had accumulated enough evidence and would be able to share in the evidence that the federal government had to bring charges against Franklin and make them stick. As in Florida, Franklin did nothing to help his circumstances, giving reporters interviews. In one interview, Franklin stated, quote, "I didn't do it, but whoever did it was justified. They were guilty of race mixing, and that should be punishable by death. Race mixing should be a capital crime." Well, in another letter, Franklin told reporters for the Cincinnati Inquirer that the sole reason he was in custody was because he had sent a threatening letter to President Jimmy Carter in 1976, and that the Secret Service and FBI had tracked him down and pinned these crimes on him because of this. On December 16, 1980, Franklin's court-appointed lawyer asks that he be tried on the state charges before the federal charges. This motion is denied on January 6th of 1981. The trial begins against Franklin on federal charges in February of 1981. With testimony beginning on February 23rd, Franklin is actually tried specifically for violating their civil liberties. As he had in Florida prior to his trial starting, Franklin had been telling other inmates, or allegedly telling other inmates, that he had committed these crimes and numerous others. And the federal government calls numerous jailhouse witnesses in their trial against Joseph Paul Franklin. One of these individuals was a 19-year-old who told Franklin he had been arrested and was put in double lockup, which basically means he's in his cell and cannot leave it, although other prisoners can approach them, because he had gotten into a fight with a black male. Franklin took this man's words to mean that he held the same racist-type views that Franklin himself did, and he began confiding in this individual about all of the various crimes that he had committed. This individual, Robert Lee Herrera, would end up contacting both state and federal authorities, offering to give testimony against Franklin, which he ends up doing at Franklin's federal trial. Basically, the crux of Franklin's trial is that he is an unwavering racist fanatic who believes that blacks and whites should not mix, and that all blacks and those who mix with them should die. It's interesting to note that the prosecution was never able to produce a murder weapon nor an individual who could place Franklin on scene as actually having committed the murders. The closest they were able to come were witnesses who were able to place a dark-colored Camaro near Liberty Park on the night of the shootings, and a handful of witnesses who stated that they saw a man shooting a gun at Fields and Martin. The prosecution also presented evidence to show that Franklin's Camaro matched the vehicle seen in and around Liberty Park in the weeks, days, and hours prior to the shooting in every regard. There was also testimony from individuals who stated they had seen a lone gunman drive the Camaro into a parking lot, park it, remove a long object, and a short time later to hearing gunshots and seeing an individual. However, the main witness to this was unable to identify Joseph Paul Franklin in court. This individual also stated that it appeared to him that the shooter was not wearing glasses. This gave the defense, when they presented their case, the opportunity to argue that Franklin was nearly legally blind. He was completely blind in one eye and had extremely poor eyesight in the other. The defense ends up calling an individual from the Kennedy Center for Military Assistance, which is basically the head of special forces in Fort Bragg, now Fort Liberty in North Carolina. This individual they called was an expert on snipers and stated emphatically that it would be extremely difficult for an expert sniper to get off 6 shots from a standing position without the rifle being supported in any manner, let alone someone of Franklin's eyesight and physical stature. The prosecution also ends up calling Franklin's ex-wife, with Anita stating at one point how Franklin told her how he had hidden a field filled with weeds and shot the 2 joggers as they were leaving Liberty Park. There are a few interesting moments during the trial, particularly when Franklin would become enraged at an individual's testimony and would yell at them from the defense table, which drew reprimands from the court. On Tuesday, March 3rd, 1981, the jury began its deliberations. The jury returns the following day on March 4th and finds Franklin guilty on all counts. On March 12th, the defense filed a motion for a new trial, stating that they had evidence that suggested that testimony given by some of the jailhouse informants had been fabricated. Particularly, Robert Herrera's testimony was said to have been fabricated prior to him being moved to a cell next to Franklin. However, this motion ends up being denied on March 23rd. In a courthouse scene, that saw Franklin verbally lambast both the judge as well as the black prosecutor before charging the prosecutor, it took 10 U.S. Marshals to wrestle Franklin to the ground, at which point he was placed in leg irons and his hands were handcuffed about his waist. Prior to this date, on March 18th, both Oklahoma and Indiana presented charges against Franklin, charging him with 4 murders. According to Franklin's attorneys, this was part of a plot by the U.S. government to get Franklin to confess to the attempted assassination of Vernon Jordan. As Franklin's attorneys stated, 2 prosecutors from Washington, D.C. had contacted him shortly before the announcement of these new charges to inform him that if Franklin were to confess to the attempted assassination, they would get Oklahoma and Indiana to drop the murder charges against Franklin. The federal charges end up getting Franklin sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms. After all of this, Franklin is turned over to the county of Salt Lake, where he is scheduled to stand trial, with prosecutors stating that they plan on seeking the death penalty. Obviously, Jordan ends up getting convicted for these murders. On Friday, September 18th, this after Franklin ends up serving as his own attorney. During the sentencing phase, Franklin attempts to escape from police custody, hot-wiring an elevator after escaping from his holding cell. After a search, a guard noticed that the top hatch in the elevator was askew. He climbs up into it. Seeing an air duct, the guard looks inside of it and sees Franklin. Franklin is apprehended on the other end of the air duct. The actual verdict came at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, September 23rd, when the jury stated that they could not reach a unanimous verdict concerning the death penalty. So Franklin ends up being convicted and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. We're actually going to end the episode at this point. We have one more to go where we're going to discuss the remaining cases against Joseph Paul Franklin, things that happened to him while in custody, as well as his impact, and unfortunately, we have to discuss his legacy inside the white supremacist movement, something that does exist and has inspired other murderous individuals to commit acts of violence against individuals who are different than they are on the surface. Till next time, my D&Ders, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Stay morbid!